This is episode number 184 with Editor-in-Chief of Men's Health, Bill Phillips. Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin. This episode is with the one and only Bill Phillips, and I'm very excited to introduce you guys to Bill. He is the editor-in-chief for Men's Health, which is the world's largest men's magazine. And during his time as the brand's online editor, Phillips quadrupled traffic from 2.5 million to a record 10 million monthly uniques. The site has been nominated for 3 digital national magazine awards under his leadership, and he is also the author of The Better Man Project, which is a 352-page handbook for men that delivers 35 key life improvement projects, plus thousands of easy, useful tips, recipes, workouts, and world-class science-based advice to upgrade your diet, fitness, health, relationships, career, and much, much more. I'm very excited about this because I got to meet Bill recently at the Rodale headquarters where he works with Men's Health. And just had a great time connecting with him. And when we did this interview, I had a lot more fun diving into a lot of the stories that he's talked about, from how he's come up with the most, you know, inspiring stories for Men's Health through his own health concerns and issues that he's faced, and how he's tackled all these things. The book is incredible. We're going to be talking more about that here in a second. But let's go ahead and dive in with the one and only Bill Phillips.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, everyone, to the School of Greatness podcast. Very excited about today's guest because he is a legend in the health industry. His name is Bill Phillips, and he's the editor-in-chief of arguably the largest men's health publication, which is called Men's Health. And thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Lewis. And not arguably, I think we are the biggest men's magazine brand in the world.
In the world. Okay.
In the whole world.
And how is that? That's all by subscribers or by readers, or how does that calculate?
You know, by pretty much every metric, there's readers, subscribers, newsstand sales, wow, advertising revenue, international footprint. By every measure, we're bigger than any of the competition.
So if you're in the fitness world and you want to get on a cover of a magazine, Men's Health is like the holy grail then.
It is, yes. And you know what's interesting is that, you know, for Men's Health's been around for 27 years, and for the first, you know, 20 probably, we didn't really do celebrities on the cover. We mostly were doing models. And then we kind of moved to a celebrity cover, athletes, actors. But then last year, we decided, you know what? Like, Men's Health has always been a magazine about the reader. It's for the reader. It's about the reader. And, you know, these guys we put on the cover, yes, they can teach our readers a lot, but so can readers. Readers can teach each other a lot. So we launched a cover contest last year called The Search for the Ultimate Men's Health Guy. And last November, we put our very first reader ever on our cover. And that gentleman was Noah Galloway, who I bet some of your listeners know. He's sort of become a bit famous. He just finished third on Dancing with the Stars. He's the new face of Kenneth Cole Mankind. So, you know, he's gone on to do great things.
And do you think because I remember seeing that cover, and do you think because he was on the cover, it helped him get to the next level in his, you know, career, getting on Dancing with the Stars and the modeling jobs, things like that?
No doubt. I mean, Noah's story is amazing. He served our country in Iraq. He was in a Humvee accident. His Humvee was blown up by an IED, and he lost an arm and a leg. And, you know, when you look at Noah and, you know, he has a prosthetic leg and he doesn't have a left arm, and you can see what he went through, and that's, you're immediately, you want to know his story. Mm. But what's really interesting about Noah's story, and what really, really sold me on making Noah the ultimate men's health guy, is he wrote in his essay that, you know, he came back, he went home to Alabama, and he became really depressed. He was not treating his body well. He was drinking. He would go, you know, days without leaving the house. And about 5 years after he got home, one day he looked in the mirror, and for the first time, he saw not what he lost, but what he had left. And what he had left, he wasn't treating well at all. And that's really for us where his story sort of began for our readers, because, you know, Noah, he joined the gym and he went at 2 a.m. because he was too embarrassed to go when other people were there.
Wow.
And he worked his body back into shape. And it's, you know, the transformative power of fitness, there's just nothing like it. Like, if you can change your body, you think you can do anything. And, you know, Noah is proof of that. And I think that's why his story resonates so well with everyone.
Wow. It's kind of like understanding the cards that you were dealt, not wishing you had, you know, a pair of aces, but doing what you can with the pair of twos, I guess.
And that's, you know, that's what we try to do every day, right? And, right. You know, sometimes you don't get twos or you don't get aces, but you play your twos and you come back the next day and hope you have some better cards.
Exactly. And it's all about becoming a better man. And I'm excited to talk about the book that you have, which is called The Better Man Project. And it sounds like it's a perfect fit with the story of Noah, right? That's his name, Noah?
Noah Galloway, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So why did you decide to write this book, The Better Man Project? And is this your first book?
This is my first book. There is, I should say, another Bill Phillips out there in the fitness industry. He's written Body for Life. I'm sure your listeners know that Bill. I'm just like him, except he's a little fitter and richer.
I've met Bill. He's a nice guy. Yeah,
he's a great guy. Yeah, absolutely. This is my first book, and you know why I wanted to write it. I mean, it was a few things that kind of came together. I've been at Men's Health for 12 years now. You know, when I came here, you know, it was sort of a two-year experiment. Like I came from popular science. I was a technology writer, and I wanted to kind of do more general interest, men's general interest. And so for me, I was thinking of men's health as, you know, a stepping stone to something, you know, bigger and better. What I didn't realize until I got here was that, you know, men's health is truly a stepping stone to a bigger and better life. Mm. And you know, I tell the story, you know, when I have two daughters, they're 12 and 9. And when the younger one was probably like 5 or 6, she came across my corporate ID card, which was the original one I got when I got here in 2003. And she said, she looked at it, she's like, "Is that you, Daddy?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's me." She didn't recognize me. And the reason is, you know, I was probably 15, 20 pounds heavier. You know, I had a bad haircut. I had, you know, I was wearing glasses. And these days I'm thinner and fitter, and I wear contacts, and I have a decent haircut, and my clothes fit. And I didn't, there was no, like, that, no, that all just happened. Like, it wasn't right. like it orchestrated. It wasn't like I read something and said, "Okay, let me go off and try that." It just seeps into your consciousness. Men's Health is a magazine that on every page, you know, every page has something that can improve your life. And you do one little thing, and then that opens you up for the next little thing and the next little thing. And before you know it, you've become a different person, a better person. And, you know, what I wanted to do with this book was sort of like try to capture all that information, all those tips and all the advice that we've given and talked to our experts, our advisory board, and collect their thoughts and try to like create the definitive guide to being a better man and you know, defined as you want to define it for yourself personally. You know, if that means, you know, fitter and stronger, that's in there. If that means living healthier, living longer, that's in there. If it's being a better dad or a better, you know, husband or boyfriend, that's in there. So I tried to hit the entirety of the spectrum in terms of how men, you know, want to improve. And, you know, one of the former editors of this magazine used to say, you know, "We don't have problems, we have story ideas." And that statement really captures like just the wide ranging, you know, editorial sort of philosophy of men's health. We're here to improve any aspect of a guy's life. and you know, nothing is off limits.
Mm. What do you mean by story ideas?
Well, in other words, you know, as an editor here, if I have a problem, that's also a story idea for the magazine, right? Because other men are having that problem too. And, right, you know, some of the best journalism that we've ever done at this magazine, the stuff that's won awards for us, National Magazine Awards for us, they've been personal stories written by editors on staff of something they've gone through. Right. Because it's where, you know, it's where the passion comes from, and you know, where there's passion, you know, there's great journalism. And you know, so yeah, anything that any of us is going through is fair game to write about in the magazine.
Gotcha. Interesting. Now I want to, you know, you talk about the seven biggest killers of men and talking about having an all-star health team, which I want to cover here in a second, but I'm curious, how did a nerdy glasses wearing, you know, unfit guy go from popular science to men's health? How do they decide to choose you, not being, you know, a specific health, let's say, guru at the time, to running a health focused magazine?
Well, you know, it is pretty interesting. You know, I was hired as the managing editor back in the day. So, you know, the managing editor, even though I was the executive editor at Popular Science, an executive editor anywhere, an executive editor is somebody who sort of like runs the sort of day-to-day editorial operations of the magazine. The managing editor is somebody who sort of plays a support role and really sort of like make sure that everything gets out on time, that it's on budget, that everything's correct, we don't miss our press dates, that sort of thing. So they hired me for a role that didn't require sort of health or fitness expertise.
Gotcha.
And you know, and that was fine. I was really good at that aspect of my job. And what I needed to do and what I knew I would do when I got here was prove to them, once I learned the magazine, prove to them that, you know, I did have journalistic chops in the areas of that they cover. And so, you know, what's interesting is too is we have a long history here of really trying to play to people's strengths. So, you know, I had a lot of background. I mean, there was obviously medical science at Popular Science. We did a lot of technology. I brought some of that into men's health for the first time. So we do an annual tech guide. And we do it sort of unlike anybody else does technology. And that was something I brought with me.
Gotcha.
from PopSci. But yeah, so, you know, that was in 2003. I've been here 12 years. I was promoted to editor in chief about 2.5 years ago. So, you know, it took me 9-10 years to
gotcha,
to get to the level I needed to be at to run the brand. And,
gotcha,
you know, it's been a great journey. I've learned a lot. It's an incredible team here. I've had great mentors, and you know, so here I am.
And were you guys the biggest men's health publication when you started, or did that happen when you were there?
No, you know, I think we probably were. I don't know. Some of our competitors, like GQ, we probably were about the same size back when I started. But you know, under the former editor in chief, we grew. We've been growing. You know, every year we would grow bigger and bigger. You know, the industry, obviously, magazine industry has gone through a lot of change over the past 5 years. You know, newsstand sales just across the board have been hurt just because of the smartphone. You know, we're competing with. Mm-hmm. With the device in people's pocket these days. And so, and obviously the economy has hurt advertising in terms of, you know, across industry wide, but magazines are alive and well, people are still buying them. Advertisers are, they still want to be part of men's health because, you know, we've never been more relevant. Like there's not going to be a time when, you know, 1.8 million men in this country are like, you know what? I'm sick of that. I'm sick of being healthy. I'm sick of feeling good about myself. You know, I wish I could be a little fatter. Like and you know, nobody's ever going to say that. So like we will remain relevant. We've never been more relevant. And I think that the brand's growth trajectory will continue. And as we get into more for digital stuff and events and actual physical gyms, you know, our footprint is going to expand in different ways, not just in terms of a print product.
Mm. What do you think has been the key to your growth over the years in maintaining that?
I think, you know, our singular focus on the reader is like our secret. I mean, you know, there's no ego in our magazine. There's no me in our magazine. Like every page of that magazine is trying to serve the reader. We put them first. And because that is the culture here and the philosophy here, I mean, we're very service-driven publication. We're a very customer service-driven publication. You know, I try to read and answer, you know, every reader email. I don't wow. always succeed, but it is incredibly important that readers have that personal connection with the magazine, because it is like I'm it's their magazine. It's not my magazine, so I'm here to serve them. So I feel like it's my duty to get them the information they're seeking.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm a nerdy. You know, I nerd out on this stuff with the business, the marketing, and the growth. So it's always interesting to see how things continue to grow to me and what makes them successful. So thanks for sharing some of the magazine stuff. But I want to talk more about the seven biggest killers of men, because I started reading about this and I realized, like, if we can eliminate these seven killers, we could really become better versions of ourselves in all areas of our health and lives. So can you talk about what these seven big killers are, or maybe what the biggest is?
Well, it's heart disease, cancer, stroke are the big three, that man killers that you hear about. You know, it does vary by age. So, you know, actually among young guys, it's accidents, you know, it's
really,
yeah. Oh yeah. It's, you know, up until I think, you know, your early 40s, you're most likely to die by accident, a car accident, doing something silly, you know, on a jet ski. So that is, you know, fundamentally the biggest thing that kills young guys. So, you know, and the most sinister, accident causing thing that we have, you know, in our possession right now is our phones. And, you know, it's, if you are texting while driving, you're four times more likely to die than, you know, if you just put your phone down and drive. And so that's the tether we need to break. And obviously, you know, driving under the influence is huge. And most people, you know, think immediately, well, that's if my, you know, blood alcohol level is 0.08 or, you know, 0.01 depending, or 0.1 depending on the state. But, you know, they've done studies where your reaction time slows like 20% after one drink. You know, we all have a drink and then get in our cars and we think we're fine, because we're not at that 0.08 level. But the reality is just one drink makes us a worse driver. Mm. So, you know, those are the two biggest things that cause accidents. Right. You know, and then also among young guys, you know, sadly is the number two, actually, I think up until age 35 is suicide. Mm. And, you know, so those two categories are extremely preventable. And, you know, a magazine like Men's Health, the book, The Better Man Project, you know, these are tools I think guys can use to kind of like get this information to get help if they're depressed. Because, you know, these are all preventable deaths.
Sure. And a lot of the things for me, when I think about being preventable, I think about having a team around us and a supporting staff or a supporting crew. And you talk about building an all-star healthcare team. And so I want to talk more about that. But for me, I talk to all my entrepreneurs who listen to the show, you've got to have a business coach. You know, as an athlete, there was never a time that I went into a competition without having a coach there by my side, either as an individual athlete or with a team. So why would I go into life, into relationships, into business, into, you know, my health without a coach and a supporting staff as well? So why do you think we should have an all-star healthcare team? And is this realistic for the average man?
So let's talk about that for a little bit. Let's unpack that. I think, you know, the first member of your all-star health team, you know, and the one that you have to be in touch with the most is yourself. You know, you know your body better than anyone. You know, so just like knowing how you feel, being in tune with how you feel, and being aware of anything that changes is the primary thing that you know will keep you healthy. You know, and when you know yourself, you know how you feel after you eat. you know, a number four from McDonald's, and you know how you feel when you have a salad. And that difference, and if you're, you know, in tune with that difference, you're going to make better food choices, you know.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you had a crappy day at work and you know you go work out for 40 minutes, 30 minutes, you're going to walk out of there like, you know, so satisfied and feeling so good about yourself. You know, it's the natural stress reliever, it's the natural mood lifter.
Right.
And if you remember that, because, and you will, the next time you have a crappy day or feel bad about yourself, you're going to think, oh, I know the cure for that. You know, let me go do some push-ups. Let me go do some planks.
Right.
So that's the primary thing. You know, and then I think it's important, you know, like we always hear about the primary care physician, and I do think it is important for guys to have a primary physician. I think it's important for guys to you know, have a relationship with that person so that, you know, the physician sort of has an idea of, you know, a baseline of you know, who you are, what your family history is, so that when you do go in and talk to them about things, that they have some background, that they're not kind of flying blind. You're not filling them in on everything that, you know, has ever happened in your family or in your life. So I think, you know, that's somewhat critical. Obviously, you know, you need to have a dentist. I think as a guy gets older, you need to have a cardiologist or a urologist. And then even older still, a cardiologist. I think, you know, it's interesting if you think about like the most, you know, biggest cause of death among men is heart disease. And
really?
It is, yeah. And it is, I mean, just across the board, right? So, but it is not, it's not something we really go, like, we go out of our way to like
check up on,
do preventative steps, get a stress test. Like, we don't seek out cardiologists and have some of these tests. And, you know, at some point after age 50, especially if you have a family history, it's really, really important that you have a cardiologist, your primary care physician can refer you, and just have some of these tests, or at least have a conversation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially if there's a family history there, because it's just, you know, unfortunately, I forget this precise stat, but the first symptom of a heart attack for I think a third of people who have them is instant death. So, wow. You know, you don't want to play around with that one.
How important is family history and understanding it?
You know, it's so important. And
really?
Family history. I mean, so, listen, you know, I have a family history. One of the other inspirations for this book was on my dad's side, there's a long history across generations of strokes. And, you know, my dad passed away in 2000. He was 59. He was very young.
Wow.
Yeah. So he, in his mid 50s, he'd had a small stroke. It was minor, but it threw his balance off. It threw his vision off. And honestly, he couldn't do the things that he loved to do. So he became really, really down. And, you know, so here was this guy who had looked forward to retiring. Oh, you know, I would say, for two decades, he ran a small general store in Western Pennsylvania and worked, you know, 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. and saved enough money to put me and my two sisters through college. And when I graduated from college, and, you know, he would have been 51, you know, a year or two later, he sold the store and retired. And his plans, like, he had a big list of what he was going to do. He was going to go to Australia with my mom, and he was going to buy a Lexus because he always wanted a Lexus. You know, a couple years passed, and, you know, I would call, Dad, what are you doing? sitting on the couch, you know, well, you know, are you reading? No. Are you watching TV? No. Like, what are you doing? Like, he literally was sitting at home doing next to nothing. And it was because he'd had, like, he was having these minor strokes, one or two, and they were literally changing his sort of brain chemistry. And he was becoming very depressed. And, you know, both of his uncles kind of went through this in their 50s and 60s. His mother, at the time when my dad passed away, his mother was in a nursing home. She had had a stroke in her early 60s, and she was in her 80s then, but she had no quality of life. She didn't really even know anybody. Wow. So I saw this happening to my dad in 2000. Actually, it was 1999. It was late 1999. He met one weekend, my wife's parents, we were just dating then. We had just gotten engaged, came to visit my sister. My parents came down. And so my parents and my wife's parents got to meet for the first time. That was on a Saturday. The next day, my dad and mom went back to their place in Western PA. And he went out to get the mail. And he was walking up the steps with the mail. And, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, but he somehow fell backward down the steps, hit his head, and had massive brain damage.
Oh man!
They life flighted him to Pittsburgh. You know, I was living in New York with my, you know, now wife, then fiance. You know, my sister called, told me, you know, it didn't look good to get out there as quickly as I could, and you know, he passed away 2 days later, and
oh, man.
You know, so that was, you know, three and a half years before Men's Health called. So I knew of this family history. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to do not long after I started at Men's Health was figure out what that was about and if it was something that I need to worry about. And I wrote a story in 2005 called Hunting My Father's Killer. Which was nominated for a National Magazine Award. I was speaking earlier about some of the best journalism we do, you know, is personal. And in his autopsy report, there was the pathologist had written all these things that he noticed in my dad's brain. And he wrote, there was a statement at the bottom that said, these symptoms are, I forget the exact word, but these symptoms, or these things are symptoms of, but not diagnostic of CADASIL, the word CADASIL. So it was, they were in like this disease called CADASIL, but not a diagnosis of CADASIL. And I was like, well, what the hell is CADASIL? Like
right.
That, you know, when I saw that, I was like, what is that?
Right.
Well, so that launched me into this search, Hunting My Father's Killer, which is this CADASIL disease. Well, what I found was CADASIL is actually a fairly rare genetic disorder that causes blood vessels to kind of like get very brittle and can kind of constrict a little bit. And when that happens, like, you know, it can lead to tiny little bleeds in the brain or even blockages in the brain. And that leads to sort of a dementia. And that's what my dad's uncles have had. They kind of like slowly went downhill. His mom slowly went downhill over 10, 20 years because of these little bleeds. My dad, you know, unfortunately fell and hit his head and caused massive bleeds. And that's how
right.
he died. I mean, he might have been with us still if it weren't for that.
Mm.
But this disease, you know, kills in a very sort of sinister way, and it just kind of slowly takes your personality away and slowly takes your life away. But what was interesting when I was researching the story is, you know, at the time my dad died, there was not a test for it. When I wrote the story, there is a test for it. And so, you know, I wrestled with, like, do I want to be tested? Because there's basically 50% chance I could have this. There's no cure. Been talking to the experts, you know, they pointed out that, you know, I had, you know, aunts that lived into their 90s and 100s and then had a stroke. You know, I had uncles who lived just as long and then they might have had a stroke. So, you know, one aunt in particular was an avid swimmer her whole life. And she died when she was like 98 or something like
that.
And they were like, to me, they were like, you know, that's what's missing in, you know, the genetic testing. It's like, yeah, you might have a 50% chance of having this someday, but nobody can tell you how long you'll live if you eat well and stay healthy and exercise, because that's really what's going to decide, you know, in the end, if this thing gets you. So that sort of, you know, that redoubled my resolve to stay fit, stay healthier, you know, suck everything, all the knowledge I can out of all the experts we talk to about, right, everybody I work with. Because there is, you know, something's going to get us all. And on right, in my family, this might be the boogeyman. So like, what can I do to distance myself from that boogeyman? And that's how I think every day.
Right. It's so fascinating. I mean, so did you end up taking the test?
No, I didn't take the test. You know, it's interesting. I might still take the test someday. In my family, and this is something geneticists wrestle with. In my family, I've had a couple cousins take the test. Neither of my sisters nor I have decided to do it. And the reason is there's no, like, quote unquote cure. So
if you know you have it, then it's like you're wrestling with this inner demon all your life of, like, right, when's it going to happen? When am I going to,
exactly,
you know, would that be more right, stressful? But then on the other side, if you realize you didn't have it, would that create peace of mind?
Right. And that is exactly the conundrum that I think about every day.
That's a challenge.
But it's a challenge. So, you know, I don't want to live like I'm dying. I don't want, and this,
right,
my story kind of ends with this decision not to get tested. And, you know, like, I don't want to be looking over my shoulder. You know, I just don't. I want to live my life. I want to live it as fully and as completely and as passionately and as energetically as I can. Mm-hmm. And I also just kind of know myself too. Like, you know, you don't want that thing
analytical
in the back of your mind. Like,
yeah,
oh, like, what was that? Was that, did I just, something just happened to my body? Like, what was, is this a headache or is this something where, you know what I mean? And I just don't want that in the back of my mind. And the reality is, like, I also, you know, if I'm free and clear, like, I don't want to backslide and
quit. Right, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, right? That doesn't mean I can start drinking a bottle of wine.
Exactly.
So.
Interesting.
But, you know, I have two little girls and they deserve the right to know, you know, if this exists in our family, so they can make their own decision. So there is going to be a time when I'm going to have, sure, to decide whether to do it or not. And, you know, certainly if there's you know, some sort of treatment that is showing promise, I think that would be the time that you would do it, because if you then know you have it and can get it treated, then that's a whole different,
sure,
that's a whole different decision, you know. But just like, you know, people who have Huntington disease in their family, which is 100% fatal, often very young, like, are often advised, those people, to not be tested for it. Because that's all that it's sort of like a death sentence in their own mind, and that's just not how people want to live.
Yeah, on one side of the, you know, what should we be testing for? Because, you know, my entire life, a lot of the times I don't want to go to the doctor to get checkups or do anything, because I'm like, I just don't want to know if anything's wrong, you know. But on the other side of things, like, if you allow something, you know, so you have like a skin issue or something, and you allow it to continue to get worse and worse, then, you know, it could really cause some harm long term if you don't get it checked out, and if you don't get, you know, if there, because maybe there are some preventative things you could do or some things to reverse it. So when do you know what to test for that's going to serve you, and what not to test for? I guess.
Well, I think, you know, if you're having symptoms, any sort of symptoms, then you should have it checked out. I mean, you know, the reality is, you know, treatment has come so far. I mean, skin cancer, when caught early, especially, you know, basal cell, which is the most common one, you know, it's almost 100% curable. And, and, you know, you don't want that to turn into melanoma, which,
yeah,
decreases your odds tremendously. And, you know, the screening tests that any dermatologist can do for you today, they're so good, and the biopsies are so quick that they can tell you right away if there's something that you should be worrying about. I mean, I think, you know, another one like colon cancer, for example, colon cancer has has such a family history tie-in. If you have a mom or a dad who's had it, chances are you're going to get it. Chances are. But, you don't get colon cancer unless there are polyps. And polyps take a decade to turn into cancer. So if you have a family history, it makes sense then, go get a colonoscopy. Get the polyps taken out. And, you know, we have a contributing editor whose mom died very, very young from colon cancer. And he started getting colonoscopies in his late 30s. And he goes every 2 years. And every time he goes, they take two or three or four of them out. Like, they grow back so quickly.
Wow.
But, you know, what he's doing, though, is literally saving his life. Absolutely, 100%. This would kill him if he weren't getting it looked at. You know, another one of my editors here has had probably, 12 basal cell carcinomas taken off of his face and body. This that's a slow growing cancer, and it may or may not have get him in the end. But the reality is, he's cancer free because he took the time to go get that suspicious mole checked. I think if you have any symptoms, go. Anything looks weird on your skin, go. Like, there's just so many screenings now that can really get ahead of the cancer and get it out of you before something, goes really, really wrong.
Do you recommend trying home remedies first or just go right to the doctor?
I think it depends on what it is. If you, you don't need to go to the doctor to get a wart taken off.
Right.
There's plenty of home remedies that will take care of that. I just don't think there's a lot of downside going to the doctor. I just, your dentist, yeah, you're like, why do I need clean teeth? My teeth are fine, et cetera. Yeah, but your dentist is also going to feel your neck and feel inside your mouth for any sort of bumps or any sort of lymphomas that you might otherwise not, know about. And, it's we did a feature about 5 years ago. It was called Men's Health Saved My Life. And it was readers who told us just, and we noticed these emails coming in over a period of months. And it was a guy who read about, the symptoms of a heart attack. And then when he had one, he knew what it was, and he got to the doctor right away. And
wow.
it was like stories like that or just something they read and they thought, God, I better get this checked out. And sure enough, we motivated them to get help and it quite literally saved their life.
Mm.
So, when in doubt, you just have to go. It's a pain. I get. Who wants to go? But
it could save your life.
It literally could save your life. And won't you feel like an idiot if you don't go and it turns out it was something that was really preventable?
Mm, yeah, exactly. What are the symptoms of a heart attack?
Well, any sort of numbness, particularly on one side, obviously chest pain. I should start there, right? But any sort of, numbness, on one side or the other is a symptom. Change in vision, headache can even be a symptom, fatigue, So the big one is the chest pain and then the numbness too. Those are the two things that you should run to your ER if you have that.
Okay. Now, depression and low self-esteem in my mind aren't typically things that are discussed about among men. What are some suggestions for men struggling with depression or low self-esteem?
Yeah, it's this is a interesting one too. I could sit here and say, the easiest cure for depression is exercise, and it is true. Studies have shown that even 20, 30 minutes of exercise will boost your mood. That'll fix it temporarily. I think that'll treat the symptoms, but ultimately you need to get. You need to talk to somebody, whether it be, you can start with a friend, you can start with a parent, you can start with a girlfriend, a wife. Depression is not a problem that's going to fix itself. It's not something that you're going to talk yourself out of. And there's a difference between if you're clinically depressed and you have suicidal thoughts, versus the bad day, kind of, quote unquote depression. I mean, obviously those are different things. But you need to talk to somebody. Obviously the medications for depression are very, very good. and they do work. They absolutely do work. And there's no shame in asking for help. And I think that's really ultimately with guys, with men. And I think, you know, you and I both could probably attest to it. And there's some, probably there's something that about ourselves that, oh, we're too embarrassed to share with right. others. Yep. You know, like it holds us back. We don't want to seek help. We don't want to tell our spouse about it or our significant other. So, you know, we hide layers of ourself from, sure. from everyone. And, you know, it's important to know that like this isn't, doesn't mean you're broken. Like if you are depressed or have low self-esteem, it doesn't mean you're broken. If you have erectile dysfunction or, you know, which is another one guys are afraid of, it doesn't mean you're broken. These are medical issues that can be treated and can be fixed. And, you know, you can't just will them away. You can't just like pretend they don't exist. There's no shame in asking for help. And you know, I was at a doctor. I was at Johns Hopkins about a year ago, and I love that facility. It's such a great institution. And you know, I got to meet with a bunch of different doctors. You know, I was in the liver center, the pancreatic center, radiology, and a few others. But I met this guy, this doctor who runs what they call the Men's Vitality Center at Johns Hopkins. And I was asking him, it's like, men's vitality, like, what's that mean? He's like, you know, it means it's sexual health. It is the place people come to when they're worried about the quality of their erections or, you know, whether they're pleasing their partner or, and he's like, but we call it men's vitality because it's not, men are afraid of that. They're not afraid to say to their spouse, yeah, I have an appointment over at the Men's Vitality Center because it's positive. It's like, oh, you're going to be more vital? Fantastic. Who doesn't want that, right?
Right, right.
So it's like even you know, the medical institutions are kind of coming around to like coaxing men to come on in. It's okay. You know, but the thing he said to me is, and, you know, he's like, there's nothing you can tell me about, you know, how your body's working that I haven't heard before. And men just have to get over that fear, you know, just like, you know, I have, you know, my older daughter is going to be a teenager this year, and she's in middle school. And there are those days when, you know, she comes home, gets off the bus, and she wants to sit in her room. And I know something's not right. And I know it's something probably that happened at school, and she doesn't want to talk about it. And I always say to her, it's like, we've lived through this. We've been through this too, like, honey, like there's nothing you can say that is going to be something we can't relate to. And, right. and as a guy going to see your doctor, there's nothing you can say that he hasn't dealt with before.
Yeah.
And hasn't heard before. And
you don't have to feel ashamed about it. Yeah.
Do not have to feel ashamed to it, whether, you know, and especially like something like depression, which is, you know, really takes, you know, not just the joy out of life, but it can also kill you. Even if you don't, you know, some people obviously decide to take their own lives, but it'll kill you in other ways too. I mean, you know, the research around, you know, happy people, I think happy people, generally happy people live on average 7 years longer than generally unhappy people. And, you know, that's just, you know, brain chemistry at work there. And that can be switched with the right treatments.
What do you think is the most important thing to focus on, or the most important factor when it comes to men's health?
The most important factor when it comes to men's health, I think that's a really good question, Lewis, you know, because there's a lot of them.
There's a lot.
Factors. Yeah.
Is it the emotional side of things? Is it the, you know, the exercise? Is it the, you know, what is it?
I feel like it all works in concert, you know,
right.
And I think the most important thing is to take one step, whether that step is having a conversation about something you're upset with your, you know, significant other or have a hard conversation with an employee or your boss, you know, but I think doing something to fix, you know, an aspect of your life you're not happy with today will lead to more steps tomorrow. And I think it's that first step. I think, you know, it's one of the sort of things I say in the book is that, you know, like we all sort of know like the man we aspire to be. Like, it's like, I can look at a fit guy on the cover and say, I wish I was that guy. Or I can see, you know, the, the super cool guy who's holding court, you know, at the bar or in front of in a public speaking situation, or I can see the guy with the cool house and the Porsche in the driveway, or, you know, the awesome family and the beautiful wife, or like however you define success, like we can see like what we would like to be, but we can't see all the steps between who we are today and that guy who we wish we could be more like. And you know, so as a result, we don't take any steps, you know,
right.
but what Men's Health has taught me is it just, you just need one step. And I talk about, you know, I talk about my corporate ID card and when I was 20 pounds heavier and didn't look like myself, you know, I didn't come in to work that day and say, crap, I need to change everything. I went to our fitness director, Adam Campbell, and I said, this is actually kind of funny. I did say, I think I need a personal trainer. And he said, no, you need 5 minutes. You need five minutes. And I was like, what? No, you know, I got to lose this weight. He's like, listen, I'll give you a 5-minute workout. You do that in your basement. Let me do it for a week. Let me know how that feels.
Right.
And it felt great. And you know what? You know, as soon as I did 5 minutes of exercise, I wanted to do 10, 15, and 20.
Right.
And, you know, like I don't, that's where my personal transformation started, with that, those 5 minutes that he told me I needed. Mm. And, you know, I also, there's another guy here at the office, Peter Moore, who's the number two here now, you know, and I was,
I think I met Peter, right?
Yeah. I think he did. So, and you know, it's funny because I was talking to him about sort of like my diet and, you know, I was in the cafeteria around the same time and, you know, I would get my coffee and I'd put my four sugars in. And he was like, he's like, you know, the ladder to leanness, that's what you need to adopt, the ladder to leanness. Mm. It's like, well, what is that? He's like, all right, 3.5 sugars tomorrow and do that for a couple of days. Then go 3, then go 2.5, then go 2. Before you know it, you won't want sugar in your coffee. And you know what? You know, probably within a couple of weeks, I didn't want sugar in my coffee. I've never put sugar in my coffee since. You know, I used to drink 3 Cokes a day. I haven't had a Coke, you know, I think I've treated myself once or twice, you know, in the 12 years since. But I can't, you know, I can remember a time sitting, you know, in front of the TV at night after my oldest daughter was in bed before we had our other one. And my snack before bed was Coke and Oreos. And it's like,
sure. Like,
I can't fathom that. I can't fathom.
What's the snack now? Apples and almond butter.
Yeah, you know what? It's like I honestly don't really snack at night. I after dinner, that's pretty much I do enjoy a nice glass of wine at night with my wife. And again, that's another tradition that is relatively new because you know, when I got this job, the promoted to editor in chief in the fall of 2012, you know, I'd worked my whole career to achieve, you know, the editor-in-chief spot at a major magazine. This is what I wanted. This is what I dreamt at, you know, since I was a college student, you know, in the School of English at Penn State. And I was prepared, I thought, on a lot of different levels, but it still was just such a dramatic change in terms of like...
Really?
In terms of like... The weight of the world is on your shoulders. It feels like when you first start, it's like you've been entrusted with, you know, this multi-million dollar brand, the biggest men's magazine brand on the planet. You know, I'm the fourth editor in chief in its history. You know, legends have had this seat, right?
No pressure, right?
No pressure. And oh, by the way, the economy's on a downturn. And
so, what are you going to do to turn it around?
And the print industry is in trouble.
It's dead.
And everybody in the world now suddenly needs your time and your focus and your attention. It has a question for you. And so, you know, I was used to sort of leaving work. I mean, I've always sort of been sort of plugged in to work, you know, with a smartphone or whatever, 24/7, as they say. But this was a whole different level. Where, you know, I would get in at 7:30 and leave at 6:30 and I still had 100 things to do.
Wow.
And I wasn't used to that. I wasn't used to letting people down by not giving them an answer. I wasn't used to not deciding on something right away because I really wanted to think it through. Like, those were things I'd never done before. Like, I made my name and my reputation was he's decisive, he's smart, he's decisive, he's, you know, he's good at what he does. And suddenly, you know, I was not decisive because I had so many things to decide, and it was nerve wracking because it was so much seemed to be at stake. And so I was never leaving my job. Even if I got in my car and drove home, I wasn't paying any attention to my kids or my wife. And if I was, right. I was faking it because in my mind, I was still at work and I was trying to solve all these vexing problems that I'd never faced before. Right. And it was a bit of a dark time for my wife and my relationship. Because we, you know, just a few short months we grew apart. Mm. And coming into, you know, 2013, that January, as a couple of months into this job, we both recognized that, you know, this is not the life we wanted to live. This was not a track that was sustainable. We needed to make time for ourselves and to connect as a couple. And one of the things we did, you know, it seems incredibly simple, was just, okay, when the kids are in bed, we're together, no TV, no phones. We'll enjoy a glass of wine together and we'll talk and catch up on our day. And if, you know, maybe read or something like that, but we, you know, and so instead of every night, which was get the kids to bed and then I was back on email and she was, you know, whatever, watching TV or playing an iPad game or planning the next day's school lunches or whatever. Immediately that instant changed, you know, all the lights were off, kids were in bed, we were in our bedroom and just connecting, just being together, just spending time together. And immediately it felt better. Mm. And so, you know, that was over 2 years ago and that's still the tradition, you know, because that might be the only hour we get right. to top that day. And, you know, both my kids are in a million activities. They're crazy travel soccer players. So like we really don't, weekends are often taking them, you know, one girl to one soccer game, another girl to another soccer game. Hmm. And we don't really get a ton of time together as a family. So we try to capitalize on it as much as we can. And that simple change, just turning off the TV and putting the smartphones out of the bedroom. And I think the glass of wine was key too, Lewis. I do.
Right. Sure. Let you relax a little.
it is. And we both look forward to that moment every day still. And
that's cool.
Just, you know, it's a small change that made me a better man. And that I write about that in the book too, because it's a small thing, but some small things can have big results.
Sure. You reminded me of the show House of Cards, where they have a cigarette at the end of every night and talk about how they're taking over the world together. It's probably a little healthier with a glass of wine.
It's always cool. Red. Always red. Red. Yeah, we want to get the antioxidants.
There you go. I like it. Well, I got a couple questions left for you. This has been great so far, and there's a lot more in the book that we'll talk about here in a second. But a few questions left. One of the things is, what are you most grateful for recently?
You know, I am so grateful for I'm so lucky, Lewis. I do. It's a cliche to say I'm the luckiest man alive, but I feel that. My kids are amazing. My wife is, you know, sacrificed her career so I could have mine. You know, I work with at a company that promotes health and wellness, is trying to improve the world and wants its employees to have healthy, happy, full lives. I have a boss who, you know, supports risk taking and, you know, Maria Rodel herself, who owns the company and that family, they support risk taking and, you know, I'll go off the rails and they'll let me do it so I can learn the lesson. And I learned the lesson and I immediately, you know, come back on the rails and it's such a healthy work environment. And, you know, the team I have around me are just incredibly supportive and in just, you know, open and honest with me. Like nobody yeses me. If you know, I think it's important as a leader that you have people around you that tell you when your ideas are stupid, because we all have stupid ideas. I think we don't recognize them sometimes, and it's important to have people that you empower to be truthful with you. You can still say no, I'm doing it my way, but I don't want people around me to just say that's a great idea when I know it's not, because the creative process is for me the most exciting part of this job. You know, if I could sit you know, we have outside my office, we have couches and some leather chairs, and that's where the team gathers to brainstorm things. If I could do that 10 hours a day, that's what I would do, because we come up with the best ideas just sitting around talking with each other. And the team is just really creative. They've embraced that process. So like, I'm grateful for this life I've led. I'm grateful to my mom and dad who worked so hard in a little tiny store that sold penny candy and newspapers, you know, so that me and my sisters could go to college, which nobody in our family had done.
Wow.
So like, you know, it's the love and support of everybody in my life that has led me to this spot. And it's never lost on me that, you know, this wasn't my doing. Like I benefited from the support and help of others. And all I want to do is make sure that I can give some of that back to them.
Right. That's very powerful. Thanks for sharing that. So let's imagine for a moment, for whatever reason, today, everything you've ever created got deleted and every magazine you ever wrote in was gone and your book is no longer around and everything is gone that you've written about. And I ask you a question. What are the three things you know to be true about life and everything you've learned? What would those three truths be about life, that everything you learned up till today?
Well, okay. So the first truth is that I would say everything that actually matters to me, I would still have. And, you know, that is my two kids and my wife. Really, ultimately, strip everything away, they're the only things that matter. That's from a family perspective. From a professional perspective, you know, I'm a big believer that talent always rises. And so, you know, anytime I've ever been, you know, passed over for a promotion, for example, or I didn't get a job that I really wanted, you know, and I remember one guy, an art director at Popular Science, told me this once, because I think I was trying to get the executive editor spot, and I didn't get it the first time, and somebody else got it. He said, "Bill, it doesn't matter. You still have your talent, and so talent always rises. So, you know, if you're good at what you do, you will find your way, because because nobody can take that away from me. The fact that I can write and edit, and I'm a creative guy, nobody can take that. That can't be deleted. That's inside me. So." So no matter what would happen professionally, you know, I would create something new, and I can create it from scratch because that's what I have within me. That's my gift. Mm. And the third thing, what is the third thing? I don't know. The third thing is, I think that, you know, everything is an opportunity. I'm optimistic that way. So I would probably mourn that deletion for about, you know, an hour or two. And then I would start, I would start seeing it as an opportunity. And, because, you know, I could create something on my own and maybe start my own company, and maybe I'd make even more money. Maybe I'd touch even more lives. And I would immediately move to that more positive place. I really don't have much time for negativity in my life. I don't sort of tolerate it from my staff or my kids. You know, it's a useless exercise, and so when I go negative, it's really quick, and then I'm out, and you know, I'm more focused on taking the steps forward, not looking behind me.
Sure, I love it. Quick thing I want to read about your book. You say here that any successful journey starts by taking the first step, and it's often the hardest. The Better Man Project opens with a collection of easy self-tests to establish your health and fitness baseline, and then provides the tools to improve those results. There are dozens of cool do-it-yourself plans inside, each leading you to the destination of your choice. Lose 10 pounds, find your abs, lower your blood pressure, dodge diabetes, be more attractive, beat back pain, fix your posture, simplify your life, save $10,000, be a better dad, and much more. So again, make sure everyone checks out the Better Man Project. If you want to learn about any of those things, I highly recommend it. I'm looking at it right now, and it reads like a magazine, and it looks like a magazine inside. It's really cool how everything, you can flip to any page and learn something interesting. And I want to take a moment, Bill, to acknowledge you for the 12 years of your dedication in bettering yourself at Men's Health, to learn about all these personal things that have happened to you and share with the results on how to become better for all of us men out there in the world. So I really appreciate your wisdom, your expertise, your constant battle of becoming better yourself and sharing that with the world. It's making a huge impact. And
thank you, Lewis. It's a huge pleasure to talk to you. I'm a huge fan of yours as well.
I appreciate it. And I have one final question, and it's, what is your definition of greatness?
My definition of greatness is trying to be better today than you were yesterday. And that's all I aspire to do every day when I wake up, is just make it a little better than yesterday. And you know what? There are going to be days that aren't as good as yesterday, and it sets you back. But if you just strive to take one more step every day, you will achieve greatness.
Bill Phillips, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, make sure to head back to the show notes to get all the links and information we talked about from this episode at lewishouse.com/184. Again, big thanks to Bill. Make sure to check out his book, follow him online, and stay connected with him and his journey at Men's Health. Thank you guys again for coming on. Make sure to connect with Bill online. Check out Men's Health. Check out the Better Man Project. And the episode is lewishouse.com/184. Share it with your friends. Share it with a guy friend who you think would like this. And you guys know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.